You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Hello, everybody. Is it that time already? It surely is. So welcome to another podcast from the Rocking Vicar. This is the Parish Council, and I'm Magnus Shaw, and he does whatever a spider can. He's Terence DeCom.
Turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream.
Maybe later.
Hello. Magnus Shaw.
Hi.
Are you all right?
I'm very well, Sir Terence. How is you?
Also very good. An alarming rise in the Thames nearby at the moment. Yeah. But luckily, I live on a hill, so on a personal level, I'm okay. But it's a bit still a bit soggy round and about.
You're veritably the fool on the hill.
I really am. I think he probably wrote it after me. Now, Magnus Shaw, talking about going out and about. Last week, you regaled us with news that you were going away for the weekend. Uh-huh. And then I understand that your leaving didn't go as planned when you stopped off for breakfast.
Yeah, well, it was the day after the event I went to my nephew's birthday party, which halfway through he sprang on us that it was his engagement party. We'd been hoodwinked. So he's got engaged to his boyfriend and everybody was most delighted. But the next morning, before we set off back to the sunny climes of the Midlands, we stopped off for breakfast at, probably a little unfair to name them, but it's a well-known motorway services brand, or a road services brand, really. Holy moly. What a dreadful experience. We walked in, it was quite busy in there, because it was right next door to the hotel we were staying in. And, of course, a lot of the other guests at this hotel were, the guests from the party were staying in the whole same hotel, so they were all in there for breakfast as well. We said, do we sit wherever we like? Yes, said the supervisor. But it could be a long time before we can serve you because we're so busy.
God.
I was like, great.
Yeah.
You really filled me with
anticipation
here. And she wasn't wrong because, the best part of half an hour later, we're still sitting there with lemons, And
I would have walked out.
Well, yeah, you'd think, wouldn't you? Yeah. And so my wife said, right, to hell with this. And it's then you start noticing that people who arrived after you have already been served, that sort of feeling of injustice. So she went and grabbed the waitress who came over and she was very apologetic. Oh, yes, what can I get you? So we ordered drinks and, just snacks, just breakfasty snacks. And then, the drinks arrived. They were okay. I mean, you can't really go wrong with hot drinks, but the food then arrived. Just at the point, we're three quarters of the way through your coffee, which you wanted with your food. And my daughter wanted cheese crumpets, you know a crumpet, don't you? But,
I know what a crumpet
is.
Yeah,
yeah. And my wife wanted buttered crumpets, and I had a chocolate Danish.
Well, this isn't pushing them to the very edge of their menu, is it, really?
You wouldn't have thought so, would you?
No.
The cheese crumpet arrived. The crumpets were about as flat as a 45 single. and you can get those Tesco value crumpets which pop out your toaster pretty fat, don't they, for pennies. Yeah. But somehow these things look like they've been steamrolled. And the cheese one came with the cheese sprinkled on top but not melted, just flakes of cheese on top. The butter was margarine and, as I say, on absolutely, flattened pastry or whatever they make the dough. And my chocolate Danish had been microwaved. So, the whole point of a Danish is that you've got the flaky pastry and all the rest.
Yes.
When you microwave it, it just turns into blue tack.
Oh, yes, it would do. Yeah, they're not designed to be microwaved, are they?
No, I could have stretched it the width of the table. It was just soggy and stretchy and sort of stuck to your hands when you tried to pick it up.
And how much was this feast?
Can you remember? For the three of us, and everything that I've described there was £15.
God, yeah. We had... I've mentioned before Tittenhurst Park, which is where John Lennon lived.
Yeah.
Where he recorded Imagine, that video Yoko opening all the big shutters in the big white room. Huh. And that's on the road between Ascot and Virginia Water, which is, as I say, very near to where I live. And unbelievably, the next door building to Tittenhurst Park, and it's relevant to know that when John Lennon moved out, he sold it to Ringo Starr. And Ringo was there for a number of years, also at Tittenhurst Park. And, you know, it's only been sold in relatively recent years. But the building next to Tittenhurst Park on that road, Ascot to Virginia Water, was for many years a Little Chef. On the road. It's still there, but it's been boarded up for about 5 years now. And I think that sort of reflects, I think there were over 400 Little Chefs in the UK, 10 years ago. And now there's only 80. I did a little bit of research.
I heard this celebrity chef, and this is assuming that I'm talking about a Little Chef, which I may or may not
be. Of course.
But I heard the celebrity chef that they fetched in to do consultancy for them on the radio the previous week, funnily enough, just by coincidence. And he was saying, you know, as soon as the PR kerfuffle had died down, and I think there was you know, a reality series that went along with it.
There was, I watched
That's
it.
Right,
yeah.
As soon as that had all finished and the PR had died down, the company completely backed away from everything that he'd installed for them and recommended to them, and sort of just folded back on the kind of appallingness that I've just described, you know, reverted to type, really. And there it remains. Now, people have said to me, well, I've been in one of these places and had a really nice breakfast recently. So it's possibly branch to branch. But if you've got that variety of quality, then, you know, you've got nothing, have you? Because
no, you haven't. And they've got so much competition now as well. They need to look out, because that 80 will dwindle even more if they're not careful. Because for that 50, you know, you described 15 quid there. I mean, a similar breakfast in a fast food chain, even, you know, may as well say McDonald's, you know, it would be probably half that for, or certainly nowhere near £15. I went into one about a year ago on a kind of nostalgia trip. I was driving back with a friend from Guildford, and there was one on the A3 somewhere there. And I thought, oh, Little Chef, haven't been in one of those for ages. And it was sort of late morning. I thought, oh, you know, all day breakfast, way! And it was dreadful. You know, it was sort of cold, undercooked sauteed potatoes, I remember particularly. Cold toast. But not cold toast like you would get in a toast rack, but cold, kind of soggy toast that's just been left on a plate. And, you know, that sort of awful kind of breakfast, sort of reheated sausages, undercooked bacon and watery baked beans. And it's just awful. Yeah. So I'm not surprised, really. So, oh, dear. Well, that's a shame. It has to be said. The one, as I said, just round the Little Chef thing off at next to Tittenhurst Park, the amazing thing was, and completely unbothered, when Ringo took over Tittenhurst Park from John Lennon, so we'd be talking, sort of, I suppose, about mid-70s, next door to the Little Chef on the other side was a really old-fashioned pub. It's now a upmarket Italian restaurant, but the building's still there. And that was Ringo's drinking days, and he was a very professional drinker. And he used to spend much of his days then just wandering between the Little Chef and the pub next door. I can't remember the name of the pub, but it was one of those really old-fashioned ones with the red sign outside, you know, flapping in the wind.
And Barbara Bach in the car park screaming the odds, I would have thought.
Well, exactly, yes, you know, but it just seems really strange, because when I think, if you watch the Imagine video and you see Yoko opening those shutters and the huge expanse of parkland behind Tittenhurst Park, what you don't see is right out on the road is the Little Chef and the pub.
No, I guess but, you know.
No. I got one other bit of any other business that we've been following for a few weeks. It's a quick thing. You know, we were talking, I think, 2 or 3 weeks ago about the secondary market of tickets for the Rolling Stones.
We started with the Beach Boys, didn't we?
We started with the Beach Boys back in the summer. We moved on to the Stones at the O2 Arena. Now, here's a strange thing, Magnus Shaw, market forces, because when we last spoke about this 2 or 3 weeks ago, we were both, I think, as were probably the listeners, astonished to learn that Rolling Stones tickets were going for £15,000 each on the secondary market through Seatwave or Ticketmaster and these places. Now, Thursday of the week in which we're recording this, the 29th of November, the Stones are playing the second day at the O2 Arena. Mm. And the most expensive ticket yesterday I checked on the Wednesday, £3,899. So the market has dropped like a stone.
No,
it's curious, isn't it?
No pun intended. Yes, it is. I mean, I think... if it had peaked at 3,000 odds, we would have still have found it absurd. So all things are relative, but that's quite a drop from 15,000, isn't it?
Yeah, I wonder why, because one would have thought that instead of dropping like a stone, they would have flown like an angel. Mm. As the gig got nearer, but in fact the reverse. Strange piece of market economics there, to which I can't add an explanation. I would have expected the reverse.
Yes, I mean, perhaps you can only shift so many tickets at 15 grand before people turn their nose up, and you have to go to pitch it much lower, or a much lower absurd price. Yes.
Yes. Now, Magnus Shaw, 9 months of evidence, 337 witnesses appeared, 300 other statements. No, it was not the readers' poll for the Rocking Vicar. It was, in fact, the Leveson inquiry, and Lord Justice Leveson, in fact, brought forward his report this very day, the 29th of November, 2012. Yeah. And we've not had a great deal of time to absorb everything that it brings to us. And of course, over the next few days, there is going to be any amount of reviews and feedback on the regulation. But very, very interesting. He delivered his almost to the minute, 30-minute speech, feedback, very well, thought very, very clear and without hardly a fluff at all. Anyway, so what he's doing is he's invoking a new form of press regulation. He's clearly decided, without much surprise to many of us, that the Press Complaints Commission has failed. And this new form of press regulation is legislation not intended to regulate the press as such, not through legislation. And I think it's very interesting that when he started, he put the emphasis on the outcome of his inquiry, that it all really came to a point with the hacking of the phone of the murdered teenager. I just thought there were some quotes that he said that I thought I made a note of. He said, "I know how vital the press is. The press must operate freely and independently. Press freedom must not be compromised." He really stressed that not. And he wants the press to be irreverent, unruly, opinionated, but not beyond challenge. However, Magnus, he said, there must be change. Mm.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, there must be change, really. I think what he's recommending, from what I could glean, is that the legislation will enshrine a new independent form of self-regulation, so that the legislation will be there to create the self-regulation, which is different from legislation that regulates. Although, as we're going to find out over the next few days, there's a lot of nuance to be picked out of this. We should remember that all that Lord Leveson has done is to make recommendations ultimately to the government. So what he has recommended is not what we're going to get necessarily. That lies in the hands of our beloved and adored politicians. So it remains to be seen whether that's what's going to happen. But that's what he's proposing, is a law to enshrine a new form of independent self-regulation. To be honest, a lot of the feedback I think that we're going to get is going to be different depending on which newspaper you look at or read. And they will be sounding off as to whether they like what's been recommended or not. The point they're missing, I think, now is that is immaterial. If the newspapers or certain newspapers had acted in anything like a decent and honourable way over the past decade or so, and perhaps going back further than that, then we wouldn't be here. I mean, they have invited this. It's a little late for them to start bleating about any attempts to adjust the boundaries that are put around them. Many of them have singularly proved themselves incapable of sticking to the boundaries that existed. And, you know, as with bringing up a child, is that you allow a child as much freedom as they can handle responsibly. And this is the case with the press, is that having, you know, demonstrated that they can't really handle the amount of freedom that they had, or at least couldn't operate within the boundaries that were asked of them, then their voice is somewhat castrated when they start bleating about, freedom of speech. I mean, if the freedom of speech within the press is so precious, then one wonders why they treated it so recklessly and managed to fumble it and drop it so dramatically. If you have a freedom that's precious, then you treat it with great dignity and respect, and they failed miserably to do that.
Yeah, they lost sight of that over the years, didn't they, very much so. I think a couple of the... there's 2,000 pages to this report, and it is now online, and I've skimmed a few bits that I thought might be of interest, because this independent self-regulatory body, they are going to have the power, as you say, Lord Leveson's recommendations are introduced, they can fine newspapers up to £1 million or 1% of their turnover for breaching this new code of conduct. That's pretty meaty, isn't it? The £1 million, I think, that would make, I think, minds concentrate a little bit.
I think it's meaty if at the end of, say, a 5-year period, there are, you know, benchmarks whereby particular publications who have fallen foul of the new doctrine have had to dip into their pocket for £1 million. I think it's only as meaty as the actions that follow. If after 5 years, not a single a publication has been fined that, presuming that the regulation has been breached, then it's all so much hot air. And it just reminds me of when ASBOs were introduced, and in the first 6 months, like 2 had been issued. So they made very good headlines, but they didn't actually get rolled out on the ground. So that would remain to be seen.
I think a criticism, not for us to criticise Lord Leveson, it looks like he's done what he's been asked to do, but I suppose a criticism of the report may be that, and again, maybe one would say one doesn't want to have this because, you know, we want to keep that freedom of which you spoke about, you know, very well just a couple of minutes ago, but this new body won't have the power to prevent publication of any material. So it's still going to be a sort of net after the event, you know, to catch the perpetrators of some wrongdoing on the paper as they run away after the damage has been done.
Yeah, it's the stable door effect, isn't it, really?
Element of that.
But is it even feasible for an independent body to vet every word of every daily newspaper's publication? I can't see
probably that. Not. In fact, I mean, he said we can't put a policeman in every newsroom, so it's probably a reflection of that.
Well, that's absolutely right. Yes, and you know, I think that freedom of the press does depend on that. But it's interesting when people talk about freedom of speech, and particularly the freedom of the press, is that the implication from some people seems to be that freedom means means the right to speak or publish a certain opinion or certain story without consequences. But having the freedom to do something doesn't mean you have the freedom to do it without consequences. And I think that's what some, I hasten to add, publications are wanting. And they are willfully misconstruing what freedom is. We have freedom to do all sorts of things, but not without consequence. So, we are, you know, free. We have freedom of movement, for instance. We can move about the country at will. But if we do that in a car that is unlicensed, or we take somebody with us against their will, then we still have that freedom to move about, but there's a consequence to what we've done with that movement. Yeah. And there's a difference between freedom of speech and freedom of speech without consequence. And freedom of speech or freedom of expression without consequence is just, carte blanche to do as much damage as you fancy. And we can't allow organisations with enormous power to practice without consequence. Nobody else can. No, doctors can't. The police can't. Even broadcasters can't, which is the parallel industry to the print newspapers. Broadcasters are highly regulated, and there's no reason why newspapers should have special pleading allowed under some banner of freedom of speech. They can have freedom to publish, but they can't have it without consequence.
No, it's the old adage, isn't it? With rights come responsibilities, and that's as much relevant with the press and politicians as it is in the rest of life. And just a quick couple of things to sort of wrap it up on, because I'm sure people will, but perhaps even by the time they hear this podcast, will have heard quite a lot about Leveson.
Sure.
But a couple of the aspects I thought where he talks in his 2,000 pages about the relationship of the press and politicians, I found very interesting. Because although he's, if you like, he's kind of cleared Jeremy Hunt of any bias over his role in the B-Sky-B takeover, and he's also cleared Mr. Cameron that there was no evidence of a deal between him and News International trading favours for positive coverage and all that sort of thing. What he does come down on is for both... what used to be called New Labour and the current government, of undermining the public confidence in politicians by creating the idea that they're too close to newspaper executives, and so therefore that country suppers in the Cotswolds, these sort of things must be disclosed, he feels. What he calls a fair and reasonably complete surreptitious texts, phone calls and emails between politicians and senior media people. And I think we can be very clear about what he's getting at there, can't we?
Yeah, well, it certainly can. And obviously that problem is one that's hard to snuff out, because it's those very politicians who will be deciding whether to implement all or any of Leveson's suggestions. So... it's a tangled mess, isn't it? It's a tangled web, really, which we can't unpick, and Leveson can't unpick either. I mean, we can only hope against hope, that when politicians do take the decisions on Leveson, that they take them on a sensible basis and not one of self-preservation or indeed political tactics as to what they might wish the papers to do in 2015, for instance. Perhaps experience suggests that's too much to hope for. I don't know.
Perhaps so. And that awful phrase, the elephant in the room, which is sort of overdone. But if there is an elephant in the room, it remains the internet, doesn't it? Because you can regulate the press and politicians, if you like, as much as you like. But as recent events have been shown, and much to Lord McAlpine's cost, you can be as careful as you like in the print media and on television, radio, whatever, but you only then need to go to Google or Twitter and put in a search term about that situation that they're being very careful about, and there you are, as Philip Schofield found to his
doing
cost.
A Schofield, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, absolutely. So, I mean, it's quite ironic that this enormous soul-searching between regulators, government, and the printed news takes place at really the very precipice of the death of printed news. Really, whatever the consequences are, they will probably become irrelevant incredibly quickly as the digital platforms just come to dominate everything. It's probably, in more ways than one, a little late to be examining newspapers.
yes, that's right. Yeah. He said, didn't he, that I hope that, you know, we've had 7 inquiries in 70 years or something. Well, let's not hope there won't be an 8th. But I suspect that if there is an 8th one, it will be more about the digital world, yes, rather than the print.
I think you're absolutely
world.
Right. And if the newspaper difficulties proved to be a tangled web to unpick, then you wait till you start on the internet.
Yes.
Where everybody is a publisher, you know? That's is beyond imagination, yes, but we're going to have to look at it somehow someday, aren't we, really?
Yeah, and possibly sooner rather than later. Now, Magnus Shaw, you've been much exercised this week. something has irked you, I understand, because it's on our running order here. You're a bit fed up with BBC radio people going on holiday.
Yeah, I
should be banned.
I hate to be a moany old git this week, but most of the topics allocated to me on the running order this week are whinges and moans. But anybody who knows me personally won't find that at all surprising. I've just noticed it. And when I noticed it about 6-7 weeks ago, I thought, it's because it's the summer. It's the summer, the summer holidays, etc. And I can understand it. But it's not the summer now, and it's still going on, and it's this. It's BBC radio presenters having too much time off their own shows. Now, this isn't a sort of an employer's grouch about, you know, too many workers' rights and you know, how people should be denied holidays or have their holidays cut back. It's the extraneous to those allocated holidays, which are usually announced on the radio. Now, I'm sitting in for Hooge and the Flip because they're on their holidays. That's fair enough. But it's the occurrence of the odd day off for whatever reason is just becoming too voluminous to be fair, really, to the listening audience. I'm tempted to name 3 presenters because it's 3.
Okay.
Well, the 3 presenters I've noticed this being a problem for are Jeremy Vine, Victoria Derbyshire, and Richard Bacon, all of whom I enjoy listening to. And that's really the problem. If I didn't like listening to them, I'd be delighted to find that they weren't there when I tuned in. Tuned in is such an archaic phrase, but you know what I mean. But I do enjoy listening to the shows of those 3 people, and it just seems, and this statistics will probably prove me wrong, but it just seems that more often than not, when I tune in, there is somebody else in the seat. And it's almost as if, you know, when you have a West End musical and you've got, you know, who should we say, Tom Jones in the lead role. This has never happened. By the way, I've just picked Tom Jones out of the air. Mm. And you say, oh, I've got to go and see Tom Jones as Dr. Doolittle, for instance. And you buy your ticket, and the night you get there, it says, tonight the role of Tom Jones is played by this fella from RADA you've never heard of. It's exactly the same thing. It's like, oh, they're the headline act, but the chances of catching them are becoming increasingly slim.
Do you know what I'd say in such a case that you just described? I'd say, it's not unusual.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. Do you know what, though? You know that your radio people who are away, does it depend on whether they are SOF or freelance? Because if you're a BBC staffer, regardless of whether you're on-air talent or you're beavering away at a desk, you get quite a good package at the BBC. You get 25 days annual leave, plus, this is wonderful, this is so typical BBC, you get an additional BBC Corporation Day off between Christmas and New Year. And on top of that, you can also buy or sell up to 5 days annual leave per year. Right. So you can give 5 up or buy an additional 5.
Right.
So if somebody did buy up those actual extra 5 and forget the Corporation Day for a moment, that's 30 days. That's 6 weeks out of 52 they're going to be missing if they're on air talent.
Yes, but my point is exactly. And then they will get hived off to work on special projects, which get broadcast later, but take them away from their regular slot. Then they've got, you know, illness, And then, you know, they might have offspring, so they get some kind of allowance.
I was going to say there's childcare in terms of one or two of the five live people.
And this is all good. You know, I'm not suggesting any of these things shouldn't happen in an employment situation. But what I'm saying is the impact on the listener is that they rarely get to catch the actual host of the show. And more often than, well, you know, a turn of phrase, statistically, it's probably not true, but it seems like all too often, you get a replacement. And the whole point of fronting a show or having a personality fronting a show is that that's what they do. They are the show. Their presentation is the personality of the show. And at a certain point, it just becomes the morning show with whoever's presenting it that day. And it seems pointless having the person's name attached to it in that case.
It happens a lot on the Five Live Breakfast show because Nicky Campbell, now the success of his programme, Long Lost Relatives.
Oh, right, yes.
I'm not sure what it's called. But where he puts people back together with people who've lost their family. Is it Long Lost Family or something? But that's been very successful, been recommissioned, and it now takes him right around the world. Wow. And so very often he's missing for part weeks where he's, if he's filming in Australia, clearly he's not going to get back for the next day's, start of the breakfast show. Exactly. It's happening a lot there.
Yeah. Well, Jeremy Vine, just this week, he had a day off to fly to Burma, did a show from Burma, and a day off to fly back. So to do a live broadcast from Burma, took him out of the loop for two live days.
What was the purpose of going to do the live show from Burma to meet that lady who was a fan of Dave Lee Travis? I can't remember her name. The lady who was in house arrest for like 20 years and then was freed and came over to meet Dave Lee Travis.
He was outside her house at one point. No, it just came from a cafe, you know, in Rangoon and he was just talking to people and saying, you know, is it better than before? And you're nice people, aren't you? Yeah, I mean, isn't it more or less pointless? Cool. I mean, you could have done a show on Burma, no problem with that at all. And you could have linked up with a Burmese radio station, perhaps. I don't know. But to use up 3 days, only one of which was Mr. Vine Broadcasting, so, yeah, it proved my point, really. Two of which he wasn't on air and he only does five, you know, it ceases to become his program. And
I understand. I think it may drop off a little bit that the major stars like your Nicky Campbell, they, you know, if they've got these TV gigs, they are going to get in the way. But there may be a slight change because that rather terrifying BBC finance chief operating officer that we talked, Zarin Patel, that we talked about a couple of weeks ago when we were looking at risk assessments or something, weren't we? We were reading the minutes of the BBC board meeting. But she is very keen that they close off this kind of loophole of personal service companies because there was some thought that some but people possibly could use those arrangements to avoid tax.
Yes, indeed.
Or, some unusual arrangements for their tax.
Yeah.
And so they're trying to rein that in and put more of these presenters on the staff. So that may trim that to a degree.
Yeah, no, I think if you're going to have personality-led shows, then that personality's got to be there most of the time, allowing for, you know, sickness and holidays and stuff. Otherwise, just call it the Five Live Afternoon Show or the Radio 2 Afternoon Show. And, you know, it takes your choices to who's in the chair. That's it. But sort of vacillating between the two doesn't really work.
No, it doesn't. And you're right, because you do create a kind of link to the presenter, don't you? If you're just a listener at home and you like particularly Victoria Derbyshire's style of interviewing or Richard Bacon's kind of joie de vivre with his, you know, entertainment world, possibly a bit of a disappointment when they say, you know, as you rather say, rather like in the way of a West End production, picking up your programme and finding a little slip in it saying Richard Bacon will be unavailable today. day and in his place will be.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And often moves me to say, oh, I'll not bother then.
Yes,
so,
yes.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you can, build a successful program that's led by personality, you've got to have the personality there most of the time. That's all I would say.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, staying with the BBC, yes. I need to ask you if you have seen a new campaign which has been launched in the last week or so, devised by an advertising company with the most extraordinary name, and many extraordinary names, but by Rainey, Kelly, Campbell, Rolf, Y and R. Mm. But anyway, they've created a campaign to promote digital radio, the world of DAB, DAB, whatever you want to call it. And it's going to, this campaign over the next 2 years is going to be running across BBC TV, BBC Radio, commercial radio, online, in stores, in places and everything. And anyway, they've created this character, D Love. Have you seen this?
Yeah, I've seen this. Yes, yes, absolutely.
It's a sort of racist Isaac Hayes, Lionel Richie mixture of a puppet, isn't he? D Love.
Yeah, I can't. I really don't know where to start with. I mean, the fact that it's been created by the agency you mentioned, who are an offshoot of Young and Rubicon. Who, by the way, diverting you a little bit here, but who, by the way, used to have their own speedboat that took clients up and down the Thames during the summer.
How lovely. Yes.
I don't think they do that anymore, cutbacks and such like. Anyway, I would have expected much better from an agency like this. Everything about it suggests it was invented by some sixth form college students, really. As you say, I think it's borderline racist, to be honest, but I mean, that's not my main objection to it, really. It's horribly silly, and it makes this fundamental mistake which a lot of advertisers make these days, of assuming that the audience are too stupid to understand basic information that you wish to convey to them. So instead of just pointing out, you know, the quality of music available on DAB, the range of programming available on DAB, the quality of the sound coming out of the DAB, which I'll come on
in
a minute. But the things that people could absorb, the information people could absorb as selling points about DAB, they assume that that's far too sophisticated for the audience. So in which case, and we're guessing that and probably quite rightly, that the target audience for buyers of DAB radio sets are not six-year-old children, but actually, you know, grown intelligent adults, we have to have a rather grotesque 15-inch high puppet who's something like a sort of mix between Teddy Pendergrass and, like you say, Lionel Richie and maybe Barry White, but very small, and in an Elvis jumpsuit. Quite how this enhances the conveyance of the selling point of DAB radio, I do not know. Apart from anything else, the whole idea of a comedic soul man fronting a campaign has been done to death. That's, I can think of several examples. Uswitch, the price comparison site, did exactly this for about 2 years, not long ago, and it's been done many, many times before. Also, you're trying to convey the idea that DAB is the future of radio, whether or not it is, and therefore something very modern and very cutting edge. And you do that by introducing a retro character who appears to be from the early 70s. I don't understand the connection there, apart from the patronising notion of having the whole thing fronted by a puppet. It really does little to encourage the take-up of DAB anyway because of all that. And besides that, DAB's problems with take-up are not about the content. And these ads are trying to persuade you to adapt DAB because of all the wonderful content. They're technical. The problem with DAB is that those who have taken the plunge and tried it a lot, and far too many, have abandoned it because the stations aren't there. They are too high, they're too low, they're too close to a river, they're too close to a little chef, whatever it happens to be. They can't get the stations. The stations they can get are variable. They're there sometimes or they're not there sometimes. A lot of the stations are streaming at 128, for those of a technical mind, rather than a higher bit rate. So they don't sound as clear as DAB promised to be. therefore...
Some, by the way, much lower than the ones
you're
making.
There you go. Yes, exactly so. So there's no point in persuading people to take up a broadcast platform which doesn't work properly. The commercial model is broken too, by the way. Anybody wishing to start a DAB radio station, thereby adding to this spectrum of stations that Mr. D Love claims to be there, can't do it because the transmitter fees are just eye-wateringly extortionate.
Astronomical.
And nobody could really get started with the DAB station unless they were part of a much bigger group that wished to be there just for the sake of being there. So the commercial model is broken too. And the BBC actually, in other arenas, show little faith in the DAB platform because despite the fact they, in 2005 onwards, they were supposed to come off FM and move all their stations to DAB only, thereby freeing up FM for community-based radio, haven't done it. And that is because they know that DAB is a busted flush. So why they have spent all this money with YNR producing a 15-inch high puppet of Teddy Pendergrass to persuade us of something that we've tried and we don't really want, I can't begin to imagine.
Spread the love. D for desperation, I think the D love stands for, isn't it? One thing that amused me, when this was launched... the campaign was launched. Tim Davey, our old friend Tim Davey, rolled up, BBC Director of Audio and Music, currently acting Director General until Lord Hall takes over.
Yeah.
And at this launch, Tim Davey confirmed the BBC's commitment to digital radio and said increases in digital listening meant that the road to a future radio switchover was now clear and inevitable. And he said this was due to listeners loving the success of the BBC digital radio stations, such as the Station of the Year, Six Music. Now, if you'd have been with us a couple of years ago, when Six Music was under threat of closure,
yes.
Who was the man at the BBC who was most linked with that closure?
Yeah.
None other than Tim Davey, now talking about the expansive success of this. But a couple of things to add on to why DAB, DAB, it's difficult to see it catching on, as the phrase may go. Just on a personal thing, I do have DAB throughout the house, in the kitchen, in the bedroom and so on. But as you alluded to earlier, many of the stations are either I can't pick them up or they've got that awful underwater kind of sound. Mm-hmm. But the one thing, you know, if you've got... It may seem a silly thing, but this is important to people. If in your bathroom, you've got a radio in your bathroom, it almost inevitably has to be battery-led because you can't plug in a radio in the bathroom.
I
do. Do you really? Oh, my God.
I've run an extension lead into the bathroom, yeah.
Do you? Yeah. Oh, my God. Well, if one week we don't hear from you...
it's a long way from the bath, I have to say.
Good grief. Yeah. Well, let's say the majority of sensible people run a battery-led radio in their bathrooms. Yeah. If you've ever run a DAB radio off batteries, I learned this to my cost. I thought, I've got just an old AM/FM small transistor in the bathroom. Yep. I thought, well, it would be nice to have a DAB radio in there as well, much clearer for Five Live or whatever, especially, you know, football in the evening, having a bath or whatever. Yep. And, of course, it was battery. And I thought, this DAB radio, I thought, this is quite cheap. It's only about 20 quid. Well, I'm serious. The batteries didn't last one day.
No.
And that's not like having it on all day.
No.
That would be like just having it on in the morning, maybe in the evening, I don't know, maybe for a short period during the day.
No.
And you think, gosh, you know, is there something wrong with the radio here? But no, they drain batteries like just, you know, an alcoholic swilling back a pint of beer. Oh, they do, yes. But just a couple of other things. I still can't marry up what now people like Tim Davey and D Love, spread the love, are saying in that, oh, you know, we're safely on the way to this digital future. When Ofcom Ofcom's own research, which I found out this week, this is current from this week, Ofcom's research says only 16% of radio consumers intend to purchase a DAB radio in the next 12 yeah. months. And currently, 78% of radio receivers purchased in the UK are analogue and don't include DAB. In other words, FM, AM. Yeah. And the sales volume of DAB radios are generally in decline. Yeah. So I can't quite see this incredible optimism as spread by our little racist 15-inch puppet, no. D-Love.
No, no, no. The it's promising things that it can't deliver, and it's promoting something which has completely missed the curve. There's very little anybody can do now to recreate the picture of DAB in the listening public's mind as something other than something that doesn't really work very well. I mean, I'd say this quite generically because I am quite fortunate. DAB does deliver for me. I think I've said before, I get 42 stations where I am here, all of them crystal clear, and therefore have a lot of DAB radios. But I am aware that that is the exception rather than the rule. And this absolutely beyond childish, horribly silly campaign is going to do nothing to address that. And it's a spectacular waste of license fee payers' money and our time and intellect. So I think it's disastrous.
Yes, and you highlight there a fault right at the very heart of the setup of this DAB business, because it's all down to multiplexes of the broadcast. They're called multiplexes. That's what actually broadcasts it. Now, we can be fairly sure, although I have terrible trouble with Radio 3 on FM in rural Berkshire, but fairly sure on FM, you would drive around the country and you will be able to, unless, of course, it's a deliberately local station, but you can hear a radio station throughout the area that it's designed for. Yes. But because of this multiplex business, you can be in your house and, as you say, quite luckily able to pick up a wide range of DAB stations. Mm. 5 miles up the road, somebody else may only be able to hear a quarter. Yes. Of what you can
absolutely.
Hear. And that's just, you know, that's never going to encourage, certainly not going to encourage mobile use, is it? And if you look at mobile use, and that's surely where they've got to get the take up, because surely all DAB consumption, almost all of it, is in the home. Mm. Mm. These days, if you want to listen to the radio on the move, and I don't particularly mean in your car, you're going to listen through your mobile device, aren't you?
Yeah.
In other words, through an internet connection, through 3G or Wi-Fi. Mm. I would have thought surely that's the future, not DAB.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I was quite surprised to see a big investment in promoting DAB across the BBC. I would have predicted a slow but steady retreat from the whole DAB message.
Yeah, you think they'd keep quiet about it, not be having their little puppet dancing across our screens. Yeah. Do you know what, Magnus? Unusually this week, our television review has been listener and reader led, because normally we get something selected by us for us by production, and we go off and watch it. But this week, after the Peep Show ended, strangely moved to Sunday night, I have to say, on Channel 4. Mm. I started noticing an increasing number of tweets. I turned over after the Peep Show and I went to Match of the Day. But I was noticing on Twitter that there was an awful lot of fuss being made about the programme that followed the Peep Show on Channel 4 on Sunday. And then as the early part of the week rolled on, people started tweeting me and said, you know... either, for God's sake, don't talk about this on the podcast, don't give these people publicity, or, and indeed the majority saying, oh, did you watch this? You've got to watch this. Maybe you should review it. So we went back and looked at this programme from Channel 4 on Sunday called Kookyville. And it started with a voiceover by 85-year-old Fenella Fielding saying, "Welcome to a show with a difference. These people are not actors or comedians. They're just real funny people." We'll come back to that in a minute. "Some of the situations have been set up a tiny bit for comedy reasons." Mm. And then we the 23 minutes unravelled of this extraordinary programme, Kooky Veal. I've got my view, but I'm gonna hand this over to you to have first puff at what you made of Kookyville. It was a pilot for Channel 4 broadcast on Sunday.
Okay, well, if anybody hasn't seen Kookyville, and there's a very good chance you haven't, because like it was tucked away late night on Sunday on Channel 4, all I can describe is if somebody took YouTube to a commissioning editor and said, this is it. This is my program. This is what you'd get. And it, as you can imagine, the most of the stuff on YouTube is fairly pointless and not at all entertaining. And there, in a nutshell, you have Kookyville. Like you say, it was trailed as a sketch show with a difference. I suppose the difference being that there was nothing entertaining or funny about it. Real funny people? Well, there are certainly, average Joes, general members of the public, people you work with, who are genuinely blessed with a natural wit. And, you know, we all have friends who we could listen to for hours because they're genuinely erudite and amusing people. Unfortunately, they didn't find any of those to film for this. They just found a lot of people who reveled in their own ignorance. And one particular character they used was just horribly offensive and rude constantly. And so what it really came down to, the premise really is, aren't disabled people funny? Aren't thick people funny? Aren't rude people funny? Aren't short people funny? Answer, no, not inherently, no. So certainly nothing there to make me laugh. This program is beyond pointless. And also the premise that we just set up a camera and filmed people who are naturally amusing when they speak. A, they weren't naturally amusing when they spoke, far from it. But I don't believe that. I don't believe that. I can spot somebody running through scripted lines, and more often than the premise would suggest, that's what they were doing, albeit not very funny scripted lines. It was voiced over by Fenella Fielding, who I love Fenella Fielding, but she could do better than this. I guess at her advanced age, she should care, but she was the best thing about it, just because she's Fenella Fielding. I don't buy that there's no script. And all I can imagine is it's extremely cheap television for Channel 4 to make, and they know that the quality is absolutely rock bottom by the fact that they put it in this particular slot. You said it's a pilot, but right at the end, Fenella said, so that's it from Kookyville. Oh, do you want a little more, she said. Well, my answer was, no, I certainly do not.
Well, I agree with that. That was my feelings as well. And this attempt to find humour in this grandmother using swear words, and as you say, then they moved on to racism, and then they hit disability by making a joke about thalidomide, and then it was, hey, let's move on and make fun of this large lady who was sort of looking for love, and then some Essex girls, and you know, well, who's next for the comedy treatment? Oh, yes, short people in a cafe. And I began to wonder who was left to sort of poke at in this. It was unscripted, if it was. It was attempting to be like Curb Your Enthusiasm, but only if Curb Your Enthusiasm was drafted by an amoeba or possibly a plankton. You know, it's just a terrible, grim, appalling, dire sort of clip show, as you say, the sort of worst of YouTube, as envisioned by a committee of tasteless fools, really. And, yes, as you say, if there is a next week, although that was supposed to be a pilot next week, we were promised gags at the expense of Jewish people. Yeah. So, you know, there was running out, there. No, it was absolutely dire. It was just absolutely frightful. Created by Nicola Hegarty, and she was the executive producer for Objective Productions and directed by a bloke called Eddie Stafford. I mean, I was just sitting there thinking, what are they thinking? It's something we've talked about before, where we've looked at these sort of programmes, and this is probably the worst example that we've ever seen, right, of thinking, first of all, how did anybody dream this up, and how did they have the gall to take it to Channel 4 and say, let's put this on? And what on earth were the commissioning people at Channel 4 what mind process led them to say, yes, that's great, let's run this pilot? And then even more extraordinarily, when the product, the 23 minutes was turned up for air, why on earth did nobody look at it and say, this is the most appalling, horrendous, god-awful, atrocious amount of tosh that has ever been produced? We're not airing it. Thank you very much, but we won't have it.
Indeed. Well, I can imagine it was desperately cheap. That's really the only radical explanation, or reasonable, rational explanation, I should say. Either that or just nerve gas was released into Channel 4 on that particular afternoon when it was commissioned. I can't begin to guess. The whole thing made D-Love look like Richard Pryor.
This Nicola Hegarty, the creator, executive producer, she is the, I think executive producer behind that, The Only Way is Essex, program. And when that program won a BAFTA award in May 2011, we should have picked up on this. We should, as a nation, we should have been warned, because she said then, May 2011, and we can see where her mind was thinking and how it led to this just ghastly, ghastly program. She said, I think reality doesn't just mean 20-somethings from Essex. Reality could be anything. So I think you could probably do this with every type of age group and genre. It's not been explored yet, but anything is possible. And I think we can see from that she was already beginning to think, oh, OK, well, we've hit the market with The Only Way is Essex. How can we expand this and do something similar in the sort of reality genre? And so we ended up with this Kookyville, which I've said it before. I've said, oh, it's the worst programme I've ever seen on TV. This is certainly in the top three.
Well, yes, indeed. And you know, they should really lash Kookyville to a large liner, drag it out into the ocean and sink it. It's just a plague on everybody involved. And you can see that there's no confidence in it, in the sheer fact that it was slapped on in the time slot that it was in, that it was almost sort of rolled out in embarrassment at a late hour on Sunday night. You could, like you say, you could almost imagine as people at Channel 4 saying, yes, sorry about this, but we've bought it now.
We've got to show it. But they don't have to, surely. There must be a capacity to say, oh, God, you know, this is going to be more trouble than it's worth. Let's just ditch it.
Yeah, we all know of programmes that were budgeted, paid for, shot, put in the can and never made to
it's Monkey Tennis come live, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, Armando Iannucci has pointed out that some of Alan Partridge's programs that he pictures in that, you know, now famous scene in the motel with the commissioning editor of the BBC have actually made it to air. I mean, Cooking in Prison is actually now a program. It's a real program. We're just waiting for Youth Hostling with Chris Eubank, and then we've got it, you know.
Okay, time for us to sort of close off really with our traditional selections for the Pretend iPod. For any new listeners, this is a piece where we each pick a track. It goes onto a iPod that you can find on the Rocking Vicar website, and also a Spotify playlist, and we pick two of our tracks that mean one each week that means something to us. And this week I am going with the Human League. The evolution of the Human League is an interesting tale. From plinky plonky industrial dirges through to smash hits style pop stars. And the story of the breakup of the dirgy version is quite well known. The musicians, I suppose, of the Enterprise shifting away to form Heaven 17, and Phil Oakey, uncertain of the future, sees Susan Ann Sully and Joanne Catherall in the Crazy Daisy Disco in Sheffield.
Which I actually went to. I actually went to the Crazy Daisy Disco.
Did you?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Did you pick up a couple of backing singers while you were there?
Oh, well, if only I had. I was more concerned with the management twigging that I was only 16. But I think
so
I'm
keeping
there
a low profile.
Yeah, I think it was in its dying days, it was a pretty rum place. And had I been 12, they would have probably accepted my entrance fee because they didn't seem to be doing particularly well. And it's long gone, but if anybody's walking through the centre of Sheffield, it's where River Island is now.
Okay. Well, with the Human League wobbling, Phil Oakey, as we say, linked up with Susan Ann Sully and Joanne Catherall, recruited them as backing singers after getting the permission of their mums and dads because they were very young. And before long, boom, of course, Sound of the Crowd, Love Action, and pretty much climaxing with Don't You Want Me in the Winter of 1981, but it's not none of those tracks that I'm picking. It's to the next phase to which I sort of drive us this week. The Human League's career after Don't You Want Me, kind of dipping again, really. And it was only until 4 or 5 years later, 1986, that they went to Minneapolis to work on some tracks with Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. And at that time, Lewis and Jimmy Jam, they were really only known for being members of a group called The Time, who toured with Prince in his as his sort of opening act. But this hookup with the Human League was bountiful, well, for both parties, I suppose, because as a result of reaching number one with this week's track, Jam and Lewis, they went on to work with Alexander O'Neill, Mary J. Blige, Janet Jackson and Michael Jackson. And the Human League had a hit all around the world. They didn't make a fortune from it because their track was written by Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis, which was clever on their part. But anyway, recorded in February 1986, Human features the electro-pop backing that was become so familiar to us in the latter half of the 80s. Also encompasses the best Phil Oakey vocal in all of his recorded work, sung with real passion and produced as tightly as the best of Burt Bacharach. Subtle backing vocals by Joanna and Susan Ann. Human, it's both vulnerable and confident, emotional and zippy in equal measure. Released 11th of August 1986, number one in the US Billboard Hot 100, number eight on the UK Top 40, The Human League, Magnus, and Human.
Yeah, it's a really good pick. I think you say they'd become something of a speciality act by the time this came out. Just out of nowhere, they happened to have a global number one and then went back to their niche again. But I love the Human League, absolutely adore the Human League, seen them plenty of times. Once from the Royal Box at the Albert Hall, but that's another story. This sort of took them back to purely electronic stuff because they had experimented with guitars. But I always remember about the Human League is that they sort of had a manifesto. I remember when Love Action came out, it said in tiny letters across the bottom of the 7-inch single sleeve, "Still synthesizers and voices only," it said. There's a little strap line, but they did actually start using guitars not too long after that. But yeah, they put themselves in the hands of Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis and came up with Human. And I know a lot of people who have no affection at all for the electro pop of the 80s and are died in the wool sort of R&B enthusiasts who love this record, which is interesting. It really sort of crossed genres more successfully than you could imagine.
It's wonderfully warm, I think, even though the lyrics are quite vulnerable. It's very sort of inclusive. It draws you in, and it's just one of those songs that, you know, I've talked about before. When it's on the radio, you kind of stop and listen to it. You know, if I was in the car park going into the supermarket, I would wait to the end of the track for it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's just one of those high praise indeed. I think that's the modern equivalent of the old grey whistle test, isn't it? Would you stay in the car to hear the end of it? It's a good test for a track, that is. So good choice. Well, quite a different pick from me this week from the Human League. The band Guillemots, they've had a clutch of devoted followers really since the off, but never really expanded beyond that particularly. Certainly never had huge overground success, which is a shame because the Guillemots' work has always been exceptionally good. And they did have an album reach number 9 in the album charts, but that doesn't do them justice at all. They're a real high-quality band, led by Fife Dangerfield, which is a tremendous name, by the way.
It is.
Yeah, exactly. He could only really be a pop star with a name like Fife.
Makes me think of bananas, but that's...
yes, all your bananas used to have Fife on a blue sticker, didn't they? Mm. Yeah. But no, he's not from a land of banana growing. He's from the Highlands of Scotland. And he released his first solo album in January 2010. The album's called Fly Yellow Moon, and it's from that album that I've made my pick this week. When my days are rolling stones, when my memories ring like telephones, and I'll have somewhere I can go, and I'll have comfort, this one thing I know, that you will put another blanket round me. So if that's not enough to get you interested, which it surely should be, because I think that's an absolutely splendid lyric to get us underway, it's the first single from the album, and it's called She Needs Me. And if those lyrics have tempted you, that's where you'll find it, on Fly Yellow Moon, first single, She Needs Me. It's got a beautiful vintage feel to it. I've no knowledge of the equipment used, but in my head, it's all been recorded using valve amps, you know, valve-driven mixing desk, because it has that almost Phil Spector-ish feel to it. Superb vocal from Fife. Means every word of it. He's got a really emotive voice, and I just adore the way that it starts off very, very subtle, very singer-songwritery, and then builds and builds to this massive string and brass wig out. And I just love strings and brass on any pop record. Huge fan of that. And this delivers that in spades. Instantly memorable. Once you've heard it, you'll certainly never forget it, and you really ought to love it for the rest of your life. It's a proper quality pop single. Totally betrayed, by the way, by its shameful 175 charts placing. How such a wonderful record cannot even trouble the top 100, I can't begin to imagine. That's Fife Dangerfield, She Needs Me, from the album Fly Yellow Moon, and it's my pick for the Pretend iPod.
Splendid. What number did you say it got to?
Well, according to my research, 175.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness me. Okay. Gosh. Okay.
He had a big hit straight after, though. He did actually have a proper bona fide hit with a cover of Always a Woman to Me, that Billy Joel song.
Oh, that's right. That was because it was used by John Lewis.
It was in one of their
ad campaigns. Yeah, an ad campaign. Yeah, so he's got a lovely voice.
So he did
yeah.
get rewarded for that. That's a pretty straightforward cover, I have to say. But I'm really much more in the She Needs Me camp, which is an original recording from him, and I think is spectacular. And I think when it came out, I was constantly waxing lyrical to you over dinner and lunch and down the phone about what a fantastic record it was. But that wasn't enough to boost it beyond 175, unfortunately.
No, absolutely. Well, that's as we say, if it's not reached the wider audience that it should, then I was saying a few minutes ago, you can find it in full on the Spotify playlist, in full on the Pretend iPod, on the Rocking Vicar website. Just look for the Pretend iPod tab at the top of the page. And you'll also hear a little snatch of it at the end of this podcast.
Absolutely. Well, that brings us to a close for this week. Probably horribly over time, but as nobody ever points that out to us, then we do so with pride. Thanks, as always, to you, Sir Terence.
Okay,
and
see you soon.
Of course, even more thanks to the lovely listening audience. Yes, that means you. We're back in 7 days. See you then.
Bye-bye.
Come on, baby, dry your eyes. Wipe your tears. Never like to see you cry. I would have never tried to hurt you.
listening to a Dacom Shore Media production.